Welcome back to another episode of Teaching Meditation, where we clearly talk about your astrological sign and Tucker's favorite color.
The number 7. That's my favorite color.
Well, what should we talk about on this episode?
Our guest today is Stephanie Nash. Stephanie has a psychology degree from Duke University and a master's from Yale. In addition to being a fairly well-known actress, she's been a mindfulness coach since 1999. She's one of the top students in unified mindfulness under Shinzen Young. She's been a guest teacher at lots of different meditation centers and an expert guest on the Deepak Chopra show.
Wow, what a resume. What did you guys end up talking about?
One of the things I was most excited to ask Stephanie about is what I've been calling Garfunkel syndrome. So Stephanie started out as Shinzen's number 2. You know, it was like you would see Stephanie if Shinzen was busy. And now she is pretty well known. She has her own world, her own field. And so I was interested how you break away from the shadow of such a well-known teacher. And we also talked about what it was like starting out as a woman teaching meditation more than 20 years ago, how the playing field has changed over the last 2 decades.
Well, this sounds fascinating. I think we can start, right?
There's one thing you're forgetting.
Can you remind me what it is?
Well, hi, Stephanie Nash, mindfulness coach. It is such an honor to have you with us here. Thank you so much. I know that Hollywood has just opened up again, and you are a professional actor, and this is an especially busy time for you. So thank you for coming to hang out with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thank you for creating a podcast on a topic that I think it would be helpful to many people. I don't know that there's many podcasts on this topic, so good for you.
Yeah, we couldn't find one, so we started one.
Good for you. That's the reason to do it. You know, it's needed.
One thing I'd love to start out with is there's not a super clear route if you want to become a mindfulness teacher, kind of standing on your own 2 feet with your own following. There's not such a clear path on how to do that. How did you become a mindfulness coach? How did you get where you are?
My path, as I'm looking around at everyone else, I realize how unique my path was. I don't know anyone else who had it the way I did. Most people go through a training, and when I started, the only one really available, there was Spirit Rock or something like that. But my personal training, I was with Shinzen. He was my first meditation teacher. I did go to other teachers over the years. But quite quickly, I was helping him and assisting him, and even started, I was very good at taking, sometimes geek out, and I would sometimes...
Really?
A little bit. And I'd call it turning it into baby talk, where I would do little cheat sheets where I'd organize what his technique of this retreat was, because he was changing it every retreat at that time. And I would, you know, give little cheat sheets, and the facilitators would go, could you explain to me what rest states are and why we're doing them and that kind of stuff? And I'd kind of put it in a certain kind of way. So I was kind of helping train the teachers before I was actually teaching, because I was good at kind of taking what he did and putting it into regular people baby talk speech, is what I called it, baby talk. And then Shinzen said, you know, it would be really nice if you were teaching, you know, because you're kind of helping train my teachers. And I said, I'm too busy. I'm acting. I'm teaching actors. I was a professor at the Art Center College of Design. I was teaching film directors how to work with actors. I didn't have time. And he said, well, could you at least, you know, come to the trainings? And I said, if I come to the trainings and I could use the things there, you know, in my teaching, is that okay? And he said, yes. Then I ended up, he asked me to edit. He had done 3 teaching workshops, and he asked me to edit these three recorded workshops into a cohesive teacher training called Talks on Teaching. So I spent several weeks listening to these three training sessions over and over with extensive notes and putting together, you know, a sequence of how this would go into a teacher training. And because to do that, I had to listen to that over and over and over again. So I internalized everything on there. I still use things that I only heard on there. There are some things I learned only from there that he never said elsewhere and no one else ever did that were really quite helpful. And then he asked me to put together the manual to go with it. So I kind of did that. And then when I started, and then people, because I explained things, well, kept asking me to teach. And I went, okay, just this one time, you know, okay, just this one time. And next thing you know, I was doing more and more teaching. And here's where I had a special advantage is for about 7 to 10 years, Shinzen and I talked at least 1 to 4 times a week. I was kind of his first call as he was working out stuff. And so I could, like, for example, if I taught a class or I had a session with somebody and somebody said something and I was going, I hadn't come across that, I would call Shinzen and say, okay, so-and-so said this or this happened, what would you do? And then I would tell him what I said, and then I would get feedback. So I had this continuous interaction with him of, you know, I'd say, well, you know, I said this and this, and he might go, oh, that's interesting. What, you know, so I had specific personal conversations and access with him as I was working through the teaching, and when I had questions, when I had challenges, even when I had celebrations, like I'd be surprised, like, oh, that worked. Let me call Shinzen and tell him, you know. So he was kind of my best friend for a while, you know. And so that's an unusual situation that, you know, you can't do a teacher training that way, you know. So that's kind of how I started. People just kind of kept asking. Then when people came to something I was teaching, someone else from there would ask me to teach. So that's kind of what my path was. And so I didn't come out of an official training, although I've been a supervisor on other official trainings. You know, I've been a supervisor for the pathways, and, you know, so I've and when we have facilitator trainings after every retreat, I'm helping run that, you know, and set up how we're going to do it and that kind of stuff. That's kind of how I got here, which isn't your usual path.
You know, funny enough, that's almost the same as my path.
Really?
Yeah, I had kind of mapped out three ways to become a Dharma teacher. One is you get real good at marketing. Another is content. You know, you write a best-selling book or you get a giant YouTube channel. And the third is like, be in the right place at the right time. You know, I was hanging out with Chula Dasa when he had a very tiny number of students. And so I was a founding board member there, and I was doing teacher training with him before there was teacher training. So it was the same thing every week. I had a long commute to work, and I would say, I met with this student and I thought this thing, and what do you think about that? It was just sort of being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. And that's kind of the old apprentice model, right? But to get that kind of personal access to somebody like Chula Dasa, who's a master teacher, and he's living it, he is it, he's speaking from it, and he's thought about it and has articulated a practice. Yeah. So how lucky? Well, here we are. I don't know that everyone's going to get that kind of, you know, access to master teachers. So, yeah, I feel very fortunate.
Yeah, and certainly not to downplay that you, even back then, knew what you were doing and Shinzen was kind of promoting you. If you met Shinzen now, that wouldn't be possible, right? It's just not easy to get close to somebody once they've gotten famous enough.
Yeah, although with Shinzen, I'd say it's less about fame. You know, he doesn't really have a lot of any kind of ego there, or, you know, it's more of his life schedule, the research, you know, that you know about, that's, you know, he's just in heaven. He's playing. He's got his sandbox. He's, you know, and so his schedule's a little different, but he's still pretty accessible. But just there's just so for I think it's less about him being famous and more about so many more teachers and people wanting access. And he's only one man.
So certainly you started out as one of like the main leadership people in Shinten's world. Nowadays, when people are studying with you, are they mostly coming through Shinten's world, or are you, you have your own following, your own brand? I don't know what word I'm looking for.
No, I wouldn't say most come through Shinzen's world at all. I'd say some people find me through the YouTube videos I did with Shinzen, and they, like, if they're attracted to Shinzen, they saw the videos, they saw me, they might contact me that way. But I have many clients who don't even know who Shinzen is. And I'm on Insight Timer. You know, I've done speaking engagements for psychological, educational, nonprofits, you know, and once you do it, Catholic Charities of LA has had me 3 times. But, you know, once you've done something like that, they don't know who he is. They just thought I was fun and wanted to learn more about this, you know. So, yeah, I'd say I you know, it changes. At first, I would say a lot of people came through him. Now, probably less than half.
I think that's a topic that will be real important for a lot of our listeners. So you gave some answers. It's about getting your own gigs where you're just there as Stephanie. But I'm wondering any advice you could give people on how to train under a master and then become your own person.
While I could teach Shinzen stuff verbatim, if you look at Shinzen and you look at me, there could not be two more opposite people or personalities. Okay. And he would point that out. He'd say, you know, he's a Jewish geek and I'm a blonde actress, like geek, monk, and I'm a blonde actress, right? So it's like, you know, and I'm a funny person. Like, I think everything should be fun and funny. In fact, he said that to me once. I said, you know, I've got a new thing I tried. I put together these two rest states of yours, and I think it's really wonderful. I was telling him something I did, and he went, oh, I'm going to go try that. And he went, we were on retreat, and he went in and he taught it. And he came back out, and he said, like that? And I said, well, actually, I put this here, and I say this instead. And he said to me, it was very funny. He said, oh, I see. You're making it entertaining. I don't do that. No, I make it academic. And I said, yeah, I know. I was thinking maybe entertaining would, you know, be my contribution. So that leads to answering your question, because I'm such a different personality for him. And I like to say things in a different way. From the beginning, I could do verbatim him, but I was doing it in a different way. So I'll tend to draw different kinds of people, you know, just through a personality thing. So that's the first thing that distinguished me. There are many people who are drawn to his techniques, but are like maybe overwhelmed at the complexity, or, you know, the style isn't good for them. So, you know, I might speak to a different group. But in terms of how to get started, you know, and it's different now. Now we're in a pandemic and we're on Zoom, and, you know, these teachers starting out, it's a really saturated market right now. Like, I did this before mindfulness was cool. It's cool now. So there's like, you know, hundreds and thousands of people, and people go, hi, I'm a mindfulness teacher who've never had any training, right? So it's hard to distinguish yourself and set yourself apart from that flood of people saying, hi, I'm a mindfulness teacher now, in a way. Like, when I started, what I did was I volunteered. I'd offer. I'd go to a hospice and say, can I guide something? I gave away my time. I got experience. But at that time, I was giving it away because I loved it. And it was I considered it like my tithing. Like, you know, I had my other career that made money, and this is what I did to contribute. And I went around and volunteered to offer things to different groups that needed various things. That would have been my main suggestion for someone starting out. Volunteer, give it away, and that'll help you develop your skill and your experience level. And then, you know, you can start to charge nominal fees or maybe donation fees, or maybe you charge for private sessions, but group sessions you have for, you know, and no one's turned away for lack of funds or something like that. So that pretty much was how I did it and how I encouraged people to do it. Just go to the, you know, support groups for various issues that people have, and all of them can use some meditation. And so that offering. Now, I'm not exactly sure, at least with this post this pandemic, we're in it, this situation where everything's on Zoom, how, you know, I guess you can find ways to still volunteer your time on Zoom, but it's just a very flooded, saturated market is what I'm seeing. And this is where I guess the credentials are going to come in. And I've even had that where someone said, well, what are your credentials? You know, someone asked me to be part of something. And they said, well, what are your credentials? Where was your training? And I said, well, some of the trainings you're talking about, I was teaching before they existed. You know, I've been teaching for 20 years now, right? I'd say, well, you know, I designed and implemented a Harvard Medical School brain study. I've done, you know, and they go, oh, okay. Like that legitimized me in some way. And I went, all right, if that does it for you, that's not where I learned, but that, you know, that gave me some kind of legitimacy, or the various studies I've been part of at different institutions or things like that. But, you know, how do you put yourself apart from others, or how do you highlight, and this is kind of when I'm talking to teachers, how do you highlight what your gift is? What do you bring? What's your... What are you offering that's maybe unique? Do you have a perspective? Have you been working? Some people have personally worked with pain. Somebody else has worked with alcoholism. One of my specialties when I began was eating. My very first class I taught, it was a general... I was so excited. I called you and said, I go, oh my God, I got 40 people in my first class. And it's during this class, and I guided, it was like a 4-hour day or something. But, and they had all these people, but during it, at one point I happened to say, okay, now there's practical applications to mindfulness. And I mentioned eating. I said, you know, compulsive eating. And I raised my hand and said, that's me, that I've been there. And this has been real key for me. Well, after that, I just mentioned that once in passing. After that class, I had 12 people come up to me and surround me and say, could you please teach us that, this eating? Because we're in these support groups for eating, but no one teaches us what to do. They just talk about it. And so I went, oh, and that started 2 years of doing nothing but mindful eating, pretty much, you know. So that turned into a little niche of sorts. So that could be something someone does. It says, you know, I have one young man who recently graduated from Pathways, is now, oh God, is it Adidas or Nike? It's a sports team. I'm sorry, I can't remember which one, but he's now teaching it for sports. And he's at the head of, you know, he's in the corporate, he's their corporate meditation teacher. And he got a job right away because he was an athlete. He applied it to athletes. And that was a, you know, a niche of something he was offering specifically because he knows that world of athletes. So if you've got a niche of a way for practical application, that's also, you can then appeal to the people who are interested in that.
Yeah, that's great. So I think the two things, if I was going to summarize it, one is just get out there. Don't try to get money. Teach to whoever you can teach, whenever you can teach. And one opportunity leads to another until you're at Harvard and then everybody wants to talk to you. And the other is find your niche. If you know about eating, teach eating. If you are an athlete, teach for athletes.
Yeah, and especially now, as this you know, is becoming so flooded, you know, to distinguish that. Now, one thing that, for example, you happen to know Chula Dasa and Shenzhen, and those are two teachers that, because of their recent books, they're highly respected. They each have systems, and so people drawn to either of those systems, you know, and that can be a niche, like, hi, I teach this system, although now they have more and more teachers coming out that know the system. So that's not like, hi, I'm the, like, there was a period of time where I was one of the main only teachers under Shenzhen. That's long ago. There's like many brilliant, wonderful teachers. I've been so impressed of the teachers I've seen. But so, you know, the technique you're teaching, you know, the system you come from could also be a niche of sorts, although depending on how big or famous the teacher is and their system is. Yeah.
So, okay. That was one of the big things I wanted to especially get your opinion on is teacher training. So the method that you and I followed is just not replicable. You know, we couldn't recommend that to people. It required too much being in the right place at the right time. The teacher training programs that I've seen advertised tend to be pretty big and pretty expensive. And so I'm wondering if somebody wants to not necessarily get the right marketing to attract students, but the right training to know that they know what they're doing, they're doing it safely. What are your thoughts on how teachers should be trained and what potential teachers should do?
How teachers should be trained, or what training programs you think are good,
should be trained,
how should be trained, what training? Because I mean, I've done some teacher training, so I could tell you some techniques I've done that I think are really great ways to train teachers. But I'm not sure that's your question. I think you're asking.
No, actually, I would love to hear about what sort of exercises, what sort of skills, what sort of programs, what would a good teacher training program look like?
I know a bit about what Diana Winston does, mostly just from talking with her. We've had lunch a few times and chatted, and she told me about what she did. And I have a sense from what people have told me about Spirit Rock, and I know what Pathways does and Shenzhen's group. And so I have a sense of what everyone's doing and how long they are. And there's other trainings, and some you go get your degrees and stuff. For me, you know, like if we were to talk pedagogy, I guess, when I'm training, and I also trained film directors. So, and I'm training them to direct other people. So it's a similar, almost teacher training thing. The main thing I look for that I believe, I don't know about Spirit Rock, but I believe the other two do give, is where the you know, you're going to give people information. That's nice and fine. What is learning? Learning, I'm not interested. Do they understand? Can they spit back what you said? It's, you know, you want something experiential. So you could say constructivist if you're going to go pedagogical approach, but also for them to, in addition to teaching, I always want to make sure, well, if we're talking about meditation, I want to make sure that their practice is deep so that they are being what they are teaching. And if you're teaching loving kindness or, you know, going to a heart open space, you know, go there, be radiating that. But in terms of the training, what I have particularly appreciated is when, one thing we did would be triads, where one person's guiding somebody else who's being a student, and maybe, okay, it's your job to be a difficult student or a student who just doesn't get it, you know. And so the person has to scramble, and to have a third person, and usually that's a more advanced person watching this. Like this would be live when we were doing live interactions. And then the third person is watching, and so they're giving a perspective. And then everyone says what that was like for them as they guide for 10 minutes or something. So you're getting a live in the moment feedback for what you did from the person who you guided, from a third objective person, then you switch, that kind of thing. That's a nice model. What I particularly liked in working with film directors when I was teaching them is, for me, an extra step that I thought was kind of key is, if they were, I would have them, I was an actress teaching directors, but I would have them for their final exam. In fact, they had to direct me to do something. So it'd be like asking a teacher to teach me. And I've done this with meditation teachers too, actually, now that I think about it. And they guide me, I'm the student, I give them feedback. And then rather than them saying, okay, I'll remember that next time, do it again right now. Say, put it in your own words right now. Just don't go, oh, yes, next time I'm going to remember what Stephanie said. No. Even if right now you're going to use words I've said, put it in your own words. So that experience of saying that with this result is in your body. And so that to me, I thought of as a very valuable way to really just get it, have it in you, that kind of thing. In terms of the working specifically with students and how to deal with various things that come up. So that was one teacher training issue in terms of watching people do that. Dinah Winston told me she watches everyone actually teach and give feedback. I don't know, Chula Dasa was watching you teach. You were just more discussing the teaching with him and getting feedback, right?
No, actually, or in not. The beginning, I would watch him. And then I was kind of like a TA on the retreat. So he was in charge. And then the last one we taught together, it was a split. It was like more my students and his students. So it felt really good that way. He was sort of promoting me over time, giving me more responsibility and watching me do it.
Isn't that nice when your teacher becomes your colleague?
Isn't that nice when
you're sharing the teaching job in a certain way? I got to co-teach with Shenzhen a year ago, and that was just so much fun. He didn't do it quite the same way of what you're talking about, but yeah, that's great.
Okay, so for teacher training programs, you're talking about basically something where there is enough personal interaction that somebody is watching you, giving you feedback, that it might be the teacher watching you, but at least as long as there's group things where you're rotating, you're the teacher, you're the student, you're the feedback person.
Yeah, or and the other thing that I know Pathways uses that I think is wonderful, where your exercise today is to post a video of you guiding something. And you have to put, they've got a little private Facebook page, and you put it on there and everyone gives feedback. And that's scary for a lot of people. Like, the first time it's like, but, you know, you've got to kind of get in the water, you know, and you're going to get salt in your eyes or whatever it is. But what that does, it also creates a kind of community with everyone who's learning. So everyone starts kind of supporting and giving each other feedback in a certain kind of way. And you start to, as you move through the years, you start to go, oh, so-and-so always gave me good feedback about that. And this person always gave me good feedback about that. So you're creating relationships. You know who to go to if you want to ask questions about this or, you know, and you've got a community support of people learning together. I didn't have that personally, but I've seen that I've seen that evolve in the students that are coming through the training program.
How important do you think it is to get a formal program where you're getting at some point graduating certified, you are now a Dharma teacher, a mindfulness coach, versus seeking out the training until you feel confident without the graduation sort of certificate?
Well, we're moving into another world now. And a while ago, decades ago, acupuncture was considered voodoo. And now insurance covers it.
Yeah.
Okay? So mindfulness is something I'd have people come to me for the last 20 years and say, my doctor said I needed this. Can I please put this on my insurance? And I said, I'm sorry, but you know, there is no system for that. And someday we hope it to be. So what we're dealing with now is the need to, and there's a whole organization started up to certify teachers just so that there is some way for me, having people be able to have insurance cover it, because it does help your health, right? But it's hard when someone goes, well, I think I've taught enough and I feel qualified. When you're self-evaluating your own qualification, today that's an issue, especially if we want to, well, for one, move into whether insurance covers it, but also how does somebody on the outside, whether it's a corporation hiring you or a nonprofit or whatever, how do they really know what your qualifications are? And so I think we're moving into where we have to have some kind of certification process just to kind of weed out. Not just saying, oh, someone says they're qualified and they're not, but you get some people who you know, Shinzen used to always say, your job is to not confuse people. You know, whatever you do, don't confuse, don't mislead. And here, let me tell, I had a Pilates class back before the pandemic when we could go to Pilates classes. And my favorite Pilates teacher came up to me afterwards and said, do you want to stay after the class? We're going to have a meditation. And I said, you have meditations here? And she said, yeah. And I said, oh, who's teaching it? She said, I am. And I said, oh, what kind of meditation are you teaching? She said, mindfulness. And I thought, I had no idea you taught mindfulness meditation. I said, what are you going to be guiding? Like a breath meditation? She said, no, everyone's going to have a rock. It's a stone with a word written on it. And they're going to hold it and they're going to look at the word and then they're going to close their eyes and everyone's going to think about the word that's written on the rock. And I heard that and I said, and then what? She said, oh, that's it. That's what we're going to do for the meditation. And I said, oh, okay. And so then I had a moment going, okay, do I say that's not mindfulness? You know what? But she didn't ask me. And so I ended up, and she's my favorite Pilates teacher. So I just said, well, I hope you have a good session. And I said, are the words on the rocks the words on the rocks guiding people towards a heart opening practice? And she said, some are. And I said, okay, well, I hope that through your session, people experience heart opening and at the least they feel more relaxed and present. And she went, oh, that would be good. And so I said, okay. And then I left. I thought I might as well just say some goals that she might, I don't know that she'd ever guided meditation before. And she was getting paid to do that. And I know people who have had training and training and training who weren't getting paid, right? So we have a discrepancy. And so, you know, and one of the things also Shinzen and other medical people say, do no harm. So I had to go, okay, is she doing harm? And I thought, to have people hold a rock and think of the word on the rock, I don't think she's doing harm. The only harm is that if they're thinking that's mindfulness, right? But I wasn't sure, you know, that's the kind of discrepancy with that. So in that way, we do want some level of being able to prove some amount of training or experience. And there's a lot of talks of how do we get certified? How do people like me get certified who, you know, I didn't go through the training program and do I need a certification now? And, you know, how do I get that? And so I do think that we need to have some way to identify a certain level of experience and skill as a teacher. We're scrambling around to find that now because it's inconsistent. Some great teachers have not had any training. You know, I don't know. I don't have a magic answer to that.
Yeah, what it sounds like is it's good to get the certification for at least two reasons. One is the direction the market is going. It's going to be just increasingly important to say, this is what it means when I say I'm a mindfulness teacher. The other is for the practice and for the community of practitioners, it's really getting watered down to where the word mindfulness actually means nothing. It means grasping a rock within, it's like a step down from eating a fortune cookie.
Pretty much. Exactly. Pretty much. Yeah. And I'd add, like, so there's the community of that. There's the, okay, I've got a diploma or certificate or whatever, but hopefully the training itself was good training and it was important and helped you be a better teacher. You know, just doing it is one thing, but getting that feedback that a training gives you and that pressure of having to, you're next, perform, go now, you know, that, you know, to be able to teach under pressure, you know, I've stood up in front of 3,000 people before and had to guide something or, you know, so that's a kind of pressure that, you know, you want to have some experience behind you. So hopefully the training is good training.
The first times that you're facing that imposter syndrome and stage fright should be under around friends, right?
Well, that's what training's for, to work that out there. So by the time you get there, you know this. You're going to have notes to remind you where to go, but you're going to know it. You're going to live it. You're going to have done it a lot of times so that you're coming in giving a gift of of expertise at whatever level, whether you're beginning, medium, or master teacher. You've had the experience, you know what you're talking about, and you're really, truly interested in the other people, in the people you're talking to, not just understanding it, but having an experience that they can incorporate into their lives.
It's an awesome responsibility that you undertake. I wanted to ask, you were talking about your philosophy of pedagogy and you used the word constructivist. I was wondering if you could say a little about what that word means, or your philosophy, how it informs your philosophy.
Well, I just use that word because when you had talked about pedagogy, and I just kind of know of just from teaching, just different ways of coming in and reflective and collaborative and integrative, but what they mean is a little different, you know. And so what I meant was that they're actively doing the thing that they're learning as opposed to reading about it or being told about it. And so that's what I mean. And they're creating, they're constructing their experience in that way.
As a teacher, as in working with students, what sort of challenges have come up that you didn't expect at the outset?
In the group situation, I started out doing a lot of group things before I really did a lot of individual things. And I found the group thing so much easier because you do a presentation, you answer questions. And I was used to being in front of people. I'd been teaching for other things for many years. The biggest challenges I think I'd had in groups are when one person is kind of taking a lot of time and energy to go into a story or something, and it's my responsibility to kind of hold the space, make sure we stay on track. So when you've got somebody who's, they may or may not have a psychological or emotional issue, or they might just be a little unconscious of, you know, and so that I'm trying to balance a whole group, and one or two people might be either taking extra attention, maybe they've got an issue. I rarely have had that. I've rarely had where someone's going, that's not right, or, you know, where they're, you know, confronting me in any way, but often where they're needing a little more time, or they're wanting to take off the track. Like I'd say, how was that meditation? And one woman goes into a story of how her spirit guide came, and, you know, she's going off into something else. And so it's like, so as a group, kind of just kind of keeping responsibility for the course, I'm flying the starship and I want everyone to go the same place. So that's probably the biggest challenge with a group. And the other one being making sure there's enough time for questions and interactions. Because the minute you open something up, that takes more time often than teachers who present count on. And, you know, and then they go over, or what they'll try to do is... And I fell into this. I was an ambitious teacher. I try to pack too much information in a session because I wanted to get to everything. And then the teacher starts speeding through. And you know what I mean? As opposed to picking, you know, constructing what is a reasonable amount of material to present, giving everyone time for it to soak in, you know. So those are the kind of group teaching challenges. The one-on-one challenges come when people have issues you've never addressed before. One of the first people I ever coached privately, I was on retreat with Shenzhen, and an acting student of mine called and said she was having an emergency and had to talk to me right away. And I drove down the hill to get reception from the retreat in my car to call her. She was in the hospital. She'd just had a hysterectomy. She had a one organ. They opened her up and one organ was connecting to another organ through a third organ, and they'd never seen that before. And they closed her up and went, what should we do? She's in the hospital. She's in pain. She's pressing the morphine button every second and then not getting it. She had all sorts of pain. She had a newborn 6-month-old autistic child who was at home with the husband she left because he had abused her, and he didn't like the baby. And so she's worried about her baby. She's in the hospital. She's in pain. She was screaming out and crying in pain. And I thought, this is one of my first private coaching sessions. Okay, what do I do? God. And what I did in that session ended up, because I had just seen Shinzen do things so many times, I went, okay, let's break this down. And I had her list every place she was feeling pain, you know, all the different sensations, and we got all the different emotions and all the different visual things. And, you know, if you do the scale, if it's on a scale of 1 to 10, everything was at a 10, right? All maxed out. And there were at least 7, 8 different huge things going on. And if we use the equation that, you know, I've heard Shinzen use, that if you don't have clarity, they'll multiply an effect, which would make it be 100 million units of suffering. And we needed to kind of pull it apart, look at each one. And I said, okay, let's pick this one. Now, is there movement? And I had her watch this movement up and down. And then we went to this pain. And then we went to this. And by the time, in 20 minutes, she was calm. She was repeating back in, you know, calm labeling of what was happening. And our whole session was probably half hour, 40 minutes max. And at the end, I said, you sound very calm. What's happening? She says, oh, I feel like I'm swinging in a hammock. And, you know, and I thought, got away with that, you know, like not got away with it, but I was like, when she named this, I just went, holy F, like, what do I do? So the challenge is, so I worked through that one and I learned from doing that, but they aren't always that lucky. Sometimes someone's got an issue you've never come across, or I've had someone call me during a panic attack. And what I said was helpful, but I thought, I'm going to go look up more of what to do on panic attacks, because that caught me off guard. I'd never guided someone through a panic attack before, right? So that, to me, as I went through, these were both like, you know, 18, 20 years ago. They've been a long time ago now, but you know, I always remember that time going, I don't know, what do I do? You know, and I don't have, you know, I don't have, it's not like the game show where you can dial, you know, call phone someone, friend, yeah, phone a friend, like, well, what would you do in this situation? And so, yeah, so I would say for me anyway, those were my biggest challenges of when I was coming across a situation I didn't know personally with someone, or and in the group situation, if someone's kind of pulling the group off track.
You're saying that in groups, the big challenge is, I always call it stopping the filibusters. Yeah, I have a question. I was born in 1976. It was a dark and stormy night. My mother was, that's not a question. what are your tips on controlling the filibuster, keeping the group on track without making somebody feel like they've just been told to shut up?
Kindness, loving kindness, kindly saying, excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you there. You know, I think this is going, and I've even said sometimes, I mean, this has evolved over the years. What I used to say would be different, and what I'll probably say next year will be different. But I would say something like, excuse me, I think where you're going is in a direction a little off that maybe won't be of benefit to the whole group. If you want to talk to me after this, let's come up and discuss that. So that's kind of my classic, you know, and I always have a kind of at the beginning, especially if it's a drop-in class, because who knows what I'll guide, you know, I'd say, okay, the only rule here is if something comes up for you or you get triggered in any kind of way, you're not allowed to go out the door. Or don't, please. I didn't say you're not allowed. I said, please don't go out
the door.
No messages here. Please don't go out the door without checking with me, because I think there's a high probability I could help you integrate whatever happened or help you process it. So, you know, my request, and Shinzen will say that, please don't leave the retreat without talking to us. That doesn't mean someone might not, but I cannot think of times where anyone did, you know, but I have had people afterwards and say, you know, when this happened, a trauma came up for me or something like that. And I'll take the time, not with the group, to address that with them. So that's probably my main thing. You know, I'll just very kindly interrupt if it's obviously going off into the dark, stormy night.
When I'm training people to be teachers, I will always, at some point, they'll be in the middle of a sentence and I'll cut them off as, hey, I'm really sorry to interrupt. I just want to point out that I have just interrupted you and it didn't feel all that bad, right? And yeah, I always like to show people that you can cut someone off politely enough that often they come away okay.
The other thing that just occurred to me when you said that, when people, I have found in training, and I've probably been contributing to training teachers for about maybe 15 years, but what I've noticed is when, and it's different because a lot of them weren't coming out of a training program, and sometimes I was their training program, but when people were early in their teaching, often there was an idea, a concept that they had to have all the answers. And when they're later in their teaching, they're much more what would be considered courageous, but I don't consider it courageous anymore, to say, I don't know. Or to say, well, maybe this, you know, to not go, yes, I have the answer and it's that. And so I consider it kind of a sign of like maturity to go, hey, I'm not upset to interrupt someone, or, you know, these are kind of the skills that come in over time. But the ability or the, I don't know if I'm going to say the word courage, just to feel free to say, I don't know, doesn't make you less of a good teacher. You know, I think that shows a little more integrity rather than to make something up that sounds good or my teacher says, you know. So I just wanted to throw that in too, because that to me goes in the category of what if someone interrupts me, you know?
Yeah, that it's actually a sign of confidence and poise to say, I don't know.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard someone ask, and what is the nature of consciousness? They said, I don't know. And anyone who says they do, you know, it's like, I can tell you about sensory experience, you know? And he, you know, and it was like, he went, I don't know, you know? And I thought, I love that. Rather than necessarily pontificating on all the different arguments of what consciousness is, or, you know, what's that serving in that moment.
I saw the Dalai Lama do that one time. Somebody said, what's the difference between self-consciousness and God consciousness? He just picked up the microphone and said, I don't know, and then put the microphone back down. And I was like, oh, great. If the Dalai Lama can do that, it's okay if I do that.
Yes, I really, and I see that more in early teachers, because they, you know, they got their notes and they're getting ready and they're doing it and they want to have all the answers, and, you know, and I think after you've been doing it a while, it's like a mom, when you first have a kid, it's like, oh my God, there's this baby. And later you're like, yeah, they're fine. You know, you just kind of go
on. If they need food, they'll tell me.
Yeah. They'll make a sound or something.
I have at least two more questions I would love to ask you, but I was just wondering if you could talk in general to what it's been like being a female leader in the American Dharma world.
Well, that is another thing that has changed a lot, especially since mindfulness started becoming cool, but which I'm going to put as about 5, 8 years ago, when it started being on the cover of the magazines. When I first wanted to teach, all the teachers I knew and liked were Jewish men. And I thought, are there any funny women anywhere? You know, and I was looking around. I wanted a role model. And so I went on a quest for female teachers. And I spent 6 months, and I went to Sharon Salzberg, I went to Trudy Goodman, Yvonne Rand, Ruth Dennison. I fell in love with Ruth Dennison. She was so, like, you know, out there. I literally just fell in love with her. And so she was one of the ones. I thought, okay, I'm not going to be like her, but she's got dachshunds following her in the, you know, in the Zendo and things like that. And so I went, okay, I can have my dog in my, you know, in my meditation hall. But I was very disappointed to not see more women teachers, and that I never really found anybody that was kind of a role model. So, and I found when I started teaching, I found a little bit of discrimination on that front, to be perfectly honest. And I had to just prove myself. And then I was in. But, like, we all come in a certain package. So I'm a woman, but I'm also a specific kind of personality and type. So I can't say that was necessarily because I was a woman. I wasn't, hello, welcome to the meditation. Yes, we are going to become one with the universe. And I was kind of fun and, you know, laughing. And to them, the lack of seriousness meant they assumed I didn't know what I was talking about. So then when I because I think lightness and humor is a great form of equanimity. I mean, you know, I work with people in pain. If you can get them laughing, there's no suffering, you know. So I'm not saying laughter is the answer to everything, but I do think that humor is a valuable tool as a teacher that I couldn't find a teacher who had any. At that time. So it wasn't just being a woman. It was that I come in a package that is a humorous one, you know. But I did have a little discrimination in that way, or I felt I did. It was maybe my projection. But once someone saw me teach or experienced my teaching, that was gone. So, So I would say if for a while there weren't many, then I'd say in the last 8 years, and I'm in Santa Monica, it's called the yoga capital of the world. But now, there are almost every yoga teacher is teaching meditation too. So there's just so many women now. It's, you know, in all directions. And if you go on the Insight Timer, you're going to see as much, if not more, women than men on there as teachers. And I don't know how many they have. I don't know, 4,000, 8,000. There's a lot of teachers. I'm doing a live program with them right now, in fact, which is kind of cool. But so I don't feel any discrimination now. It's common. But starting out, I was an odd duck. And I didn't know. I thought, you know what? I think I need to leave the Buddhist community. Because at that time, it was mostly Buddhist teachers. And I thought, I felt I would never be accepted. And so I kind of, early on, kind of moved to the secular world a little bit because the thing that I loved the most was practical application of mindfulness. And so that was part of my niche in that. But so other than kind of being one of the first ones out there and going, where's my role model? But I've had many people come up behind me and tell me I was their role model. And I went, okay.
Oh,
you know, that's good.
What a good feeling.
It was sweet. Yeah. And it was somebody I was complimenting, because that's the other thing that I'm real big on now. Because I do, as you do, obviously you're saying you train teachers. I want teachers to be appreciated. You know, like we want our healthcare workers to be appreciated now. And there was a time when going to the grocery store was taking your life in your hands, and we wanted to appreciate those workers. Anytime anyone is contributing to teaching in any way, I want to always express appreciation to them, because I don't think there's, like I said, it's a flooded market, but you know, if everyone's a meditation teacher, we're good, you know. This is a virus we want to spread, you know. And so I'm always appreciative of anyone who's put in the time to want to teach something that helps people transform their experience. So I'm the one who goes around going, oh, you're so wonderful. Oh, you're so wonderful. So I walk around, I'm doing mama God, you know, I'm walking around going, oh, baby, you're so good, you know, just to give appreciation for teachers, because there are challenges, but I think it's a noble occupation to do.
I had interviewed Shinzen last week, and he was saying, you know, Dharma teaching, it's great. It's an easy job. And I was like, oh my God, I don't feel that way at all. You know, it may be an intro class if people aren't kind of relating to you as a spiritual teacher. But once they are, it feels like this awesome, terrifying responsibility that you have now taken on. And I guess I think that might be the last question I would want to ask you today. When you really get into this, it's a big deal, right? If people are wondering if they should follow that path, how would you know if you're ready, and how would you know if you are not ready?
Well, I think, and by the way, when Shinzen says it's easy, he's never done anything else. Okay, so he's been doing it. He's never done anything else. So it's for him like breathing, right? And I've gone to sweat lodge ceremonies with him, or we're driving people and he just can't help teaching everyone on the way. You know, it's just, that's just what he does. The process of learning to be a teacher, fortunately, isn't a quick one. So you have time to, it's kind of like you're going to try it on and see how it feels. And rather than making a determination or a story or an evaluation before you've even tried it, it's kind of like, you know, some people want to be actors and they take an acting class and they go, wow, this is great. Or they take an acting class and go, that is the most traumatic thing I've ever had in my life. I don't want to go anywhere near it. So you could go into, a lot of people have gone into the teacher training, said, this is really great. This is really wonderful. I definitely do not want to do that for a living. You know? So, you know, luckily it's a process. It takes a while. So you have time to try things on and not just see if you're ready, but see if it fits you, if it goes with your personality, if it goes with your passion, because a big part of it is this desire. What I say is a desire to serve. This, you know, the way I put it is, I don't know how, I'm a lot older than you, and I don't know how much longer I'm going to be on the planet, but I'd sure like to contribute and make it, leave it better than I found it. And so if someone who is a teacher isn't going, hi, I want to be a great teacher, but they just really want to help people, that is, in fact, I'll sometimes ask people, they say, should I do this? And I say, well, why are you thinking of doing it? What are your reasons? What are your motivations? You know, and so, you know, and it might be they really want to do it, but they're just, they don't have a personality for it, or they, you know, maybe have to go work on something else with themselves for a while first to come back. So luckily that process is long enough that they can try it. And because it's going, you're going to have times like you talked earlier about having to do something, the telemarketing, you have to do something where you go, oh, that doesn't feel good. So like you might say, I want to be a teacher. It's great. And then you go and you do a presentation and everyone tells you it's terrible. And some people will go, oh, damn it, I'm going to do better next time. And other people are going to go home, put their head under the pillow and never come out again and say, never mind, I don't want to be a teacher. I can't handle that. Right. So it's going to be different for different people, but the person who put their head under the pillow may come back out in 2 weeks and say, you know what? I did a great self-compassion exercise that, you know, has really shifted, and I think this could be my growing edge. You know, who knows? It's nice if, as a teacher, awesome, you're growing as you're teaching and you're learning as you're teaching, I think.
I love that. So how do you know if you're ready? Your motivation feels pure, and then give it a shot. And if you hate it, do something else.
Kinda. And if you hate it, of course, do something else. The other thing is look to see what feedback you're getting. Like if you're not in a training program, and for me, I would watch what my students, how they were responding, what their experience was, how they were growing. And that's when I discovered, and I went, there's a word for it. It's called mudita. And I went, oh my God, the joy, the absolute joy I got. Like if someone says, you're a great teacher, I'm like, uh-huh, yeah, that's fine. I've been an actress on stage where everyone goes, oh, you're wonderful. And I go, no, that's a role I played. Okay, you know. So you don't need that anymore. When someone says, oh, I just realized, I just had this aha. Oh, now I understand what my habit of anxiety was. Like when they give this feedback of what they learned or what they're open to, that to me is, oh, joy, delight. It's like they're, mudita, I believe, is translated as joy. They say sympathetic joy, but it's happiness at somebody else's growth. And Shinzen would say that's, it's actually more specifically towards their spiritual growth. But when a student says that, that's just such a delight. And that's, to me, the best payment as a teacher is when someone goes, oh, you know, I got an aha. Or, you know what, I had this happened more than once, but I had someone who's learning. I start people in the practice, like Lee Brazington's a teacher, and he said, you know what, you do is harder. I only work with people after they've done long retreats. He said, you're starting people in a practice, that's harder. And when I'm starting people in the practice, I have to tune them into, are they getting benefits in their life? And so I remember after 2 weeks, one time I turned to one man, but I've had this happen with three. And I said, so are you noticing any difference in your life? And he went, no, everything's the same. I said, okay, well, how's work? Oh, I'm much more productive. For some reason, I'm getting more done in less time. I went, oh, okay. How about your relationships? And he said, oh, my wife is so much nicer. She must like that I'm meditating. And I went, yeah, that must be it, you know. But, you know, obviously they were getting benefits they didn't notice. So that's also rewarding. Even though they didn't go, oh, I had an aha, I'm seeing their lives change. They say, I'm less emotionally reactive. I'm able to be productive. I'm, you know, I can engage in a more meaningful way in my relationships, you know, ding. So that's another feedback of how are the people you're working with growing and feeling that reward.
Yeah. Oh, man, what an inspiring and lovely way to end. You have spent so much time, obviously, practicing teaching and also thinking about teacher training and pedagogy. And I've just been so excited to have you on our podcast here. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. What a treat.
And enjoy. I think you're teaching a retreat this weekend.
Yeah, Susan has a retreat, and I'm teaching tomorrow morning. And I'm just offering like eating meditations and posture because we know I do that. And so these are the things. And again, it's like, what can I contribute that they need, right? And these are specialties of mine. So once again, my niche. And I'm coming in and I'm just offering it instead of ringing a bell or whatever other people do at retreats, just to contribute. But it's a delight and a joy to do it, and a delight and a joy to speak with you, and a delight and a joy that you're doing this because you're offering this to everyone.
Well, thank you so very much.
Teaching Meditation is a labor of love for you, our listeners. It's produced by John Dooley and sound engineered by Jared Hammond.
John and Jared are volunteering their time to help produce this show. We'd like to compensate them as well as we can since they are professionals. If you can help out with that at all, you can head to patreon.com/teachingmeditation. We and they will be so grateful for anything you're able to offer. Thanks for listening.
Also, please be sure to subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen.